Oh, hello, and welcome to episode 5 of Prepare to Fast Forward, our chance to leave the warm, cozy comfort of nostalgia behind and hurtle headfirst, kicking and screaming into the present day, at least the popular culture of the present day. It's June 2023, a lot has happened since we last spoke, but let's not get into all that. I'm not even going to make any jokes about the tears of the United Kingdom during our presumably lengthy discussion about the new Legend of Zelda. My name's Steve, and it's very hot today. It's very hot. And although I've done my best to eliminate it, you might hear some street noises through my open window. I apologise, but as much as I love the Wolfie Pod, there are a few things I'm willing to literally melt to death for. So I'll be your host for this one, but don't worry. While travelling forward in time, I've managed to grab 3 familiar voices on the way, and I'll now awkwardly segue into introducing them one by one. First, we have Jason.
Hello.
And we have Rich.
Hello.
And we have Chris.
Hello there.
Ooh, so, that was quite sexy.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's setting the tone for the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Our secret voice.
Before getting into it proper. Oh, sorry.
Was that the ice cream, man?
Ice cream.
That was the timing of perfect.
Image of the day as well. It's always the classic.
So, who is that? Is that me?
I don't know. It's not me.
It's not me either.
We get must be me then. We get a copyright strike for that from the ice cream union or whatever.
Amazing.
From Cornetto.
Big ice cream.
Why do these things always have like the most perfect of timing?
Poor Chris was entering to an ice cream jingle. It's like his little backing music here. It's the theme tune.
Yeah, I'm secretly an ice cream man.
I'm keeping that in.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Sorry, Steve.
It's all right.
Carry on.
It's fine. It's the ice cream van's fault. Before getting into it proper, I just want to ask you all a question out of left field. So the world's a little bit scary right now, but hey, everything's going to turn out all right. I'm an optimist and I have a good reason to be. But with that in mind, I just want to ask everyone, as you're all here, alive and well, as proof that we're a resilient bunch, what's the scariest situation that you've ever found yourself in?
Actually, kind of right now, as you actually posed that question, I looked up and there's a big spider in the corner of my room. So I was actually going to bring up spiders anyway. I think it's probably not one isolated event that's happened, but probably several where I'm just minding my own business watching TV and a thing just catches a corner of your eye, spider on the floor, disappears under some hard to access furniture, and you just, yeah. There are like specific scenarios I can think of, but they're probably too depressing for the podcast. So I'm going to go light and do more of a broader event. And I think any time a spider enters my house is probably the most terrifying time for me. Mm-hmm. So I freeze up, can't function. I just go to bed at that point. Even doesn't matter what time of day it is. I'm just like, yeah, I'm gone. See you later. Bye. Shut the door.
Are we actually talking like the little ones as well?
No, it has to be a certain size. You get towards like the garden spider variety when they've got like fucking practically got fucking clothes on. They're that big. Seriously, they're just yeah.
What I like to call them? I share your fear of spiders. Like definitely afraid of them, and I call them spiders with knives for legs that go chink 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 on the floor. You know, he's like fuck that. I'm out. Yeah.
Well, so I mean, it's not something that I get into that often because it's a vulnerability of mine. But I also have a pretty serious phobia of spiders. And when I was a kid, there was a massive one in my bed in my bedroom, and it was like 2 a.m. My parents had to drag all of the furniture out of the bedroom to find it because I refused to go upstairs until it was gone. So, yeah, solidarity, Rich, on that one. Spiders suck.
Yeah,
I will be more specific for a second. There was one time when I was a kid when I stood barefooted on a wasp. That was terrifying.
Ouch.
Because that was, like, terrifying and also just surging, soaring pain. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought I was going to lose my foot because I was just young and didn't know any better. It was just laying on the bathroom floor. I think it was, like, partly dead. And it just went, dink, right in my foot. And, yeah, that was terrifying. Probably more terrifying than most things I've experienced in my adult life. So,
what the hell was it doing there?
I don't know. Just at the base of the toilet, like
just wasping. Just
trying to
rude.
It tried to have a shit and fell off. I don't know what happened. So,
and yeah, I have a big phobia of spiders and airplanes and airports in general.
Spiders in airports. Oh, no.
Spiders in airports. Spiders on a plane. That's my worst thing ever. I don't mind snakes. Snakes can be on a plane. Snakes are quite cute. They've got cute little faces, and yeah, obviously the venomous type can kill you. But I do not like, as a segue here, I do not like airports, and I do not like flying. My mum and family seem to think that I had a bad experience when I was like one or two, because they used to fly to France all the time. So I think it's like that imprinted survival mode on me that I no longer like airports or airplanes or anything to do with them. And that's two of my phobias. But as for scary situations, Rich might remember this, like 2 days before Christmas holidays, 1996. We hadn't met then, I don't think.
I think I remember this story. I think I know what you're going to say, but...
The whole school knows about this story. It's not embarrassing. It's quite horrific, actually.
It's proper casualty.
A few of my mates were mucking around in the car park in the school grounds near the gates, and we both tripped on an uneven slab and went through a window. He got a cut on his arm, and my wrist was sliced open in the instant. And it's an impressive scar, and I've never been so frightened in my life. Thinking you see all these films where people, you know, get their wrists cut and they can die within 30 seconds. And I just remember I've cut my fucking wrist open, and I ran to the nurse's room, and the nurse had gone home. Two ambulances pulled up at the school. I was in shock, obviously. And as I left the school to go to A&E, about 200 school students were standing outside the school wondering what the fuck was going on at 3:30 in the afternoon. Yeah, so that was 5-6 stitches later, and I nearly lost my hand.
So you're a legend then at your school, really? That's that kind of...
I wouldn't say it's a legend.
Legacy.
I nearly lost my hand and the movement of my hand, which, being a person who enjoys hobbies and craft and art, was a horrible thing to come to terms with, but luckily, still here.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can see the scar on my wrist, but... No.
Be a very clumsy unboxing channel. That's what I'd say.
Yeah. So that was probably the scariest point of my entire life. And then 2 years ago,
it's a pretty good one.
Mate, I was distraught. I was like, there's going to be nerve damage, tendon damage. There is nerve damage, but it's nothing you can't, you know, it's not severe. I didn't lose any movement on my hand, nothing. I was very lucky. But,
crikey.
And the second one was when I crashed my car about 2 years ago.
Were there any windows involved in that, or was that just...
No, just the car, and the front half was written off, essentially. So the entire front of our car is new. I slammed into the grass. I turned left, and the car just skidded along the road and hit the verge and went up it.
So, I mean, you've defeated both window and car. Now, both of those things know not to fuck with you.
Spiders still do, though. Yeah.
Blimey. Well, we're glad that you're still here, Chris. Well done. Good work.
The one that always springs to the top of my brain is this one. We went on a 2-week holiday to Cuba, probably about 2 years after I met my good wife, and we decided to take an internal flight from where we were staying on one side of Cuba to Havana, you know, have an overnight stay and experience all the delights that Havana can offer you and all this that stuff. And the internal flight was an hour long each way. So, yeah, not too bad. The one going out to Havana was fine. But then on the one coming back, the weather was not good. It was gloomy. It was raining. There was lightning. And I'm sitting at the airport and I'm going, surely this flight is not going to go ahead thanks to this weather. But it did. It was fine, they said. Let's crack on with the flight. And we're not talking, obviously, it's an internal flight. So it's not the biggest plane in the world. It's got like a propeller plane as well.
Oh, no.
We got in this plane and we took off. Fucking rain's lashing against the window. Fucking lightning going off outside. I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing here? And then the turbulence came. And we had turbulence for a while. And then all of a sudden, I'm not lying to you here, like it felt like we dropped about 20,000 feet in about 2 seconds.
Oh,
right. And I literally just clinged onto thankfully the seat in front of me was empty, because I just went, clinged onto the headrest in front of me. I went, please don't let me die. Please don't let me die. I seriously thought I was literally going to die in this stupid little plane flying over Cuba. But we didn't. When we regained our altitude, and I'm sure it probably was about 1,000 feet or something, or even not even 1,000 feet that we dropped. But to me, it felt like, do you know, like on a roller coaster, you can, and you go down that first drop or whatever. It just felt like that. And it scared the hell out of me. And to the, you know, we landed at the airport. I saw the captain. I was getting my bags, and I saw the captain, which is laughing it off, shrugged it. He's like, nah, it's nothing. I don't know what you're talking about. Didn't have a day at the office. So,
I mean, that's the thing. Like, he's probably right. But, like, he's in planes all the time, so yeah. He knows that. But when you're a passenger in the back and you don't know that, man, that is terrifying.
Yeah, and to this day, that freaked me out with flying ever since. And I don't like flying anymore. It's just, we've been to Florida a couple of times, and we've flown to other places, and I'll do it. I want to go to Japan. I'll do it. This is what I need to do to get to these places and experience these cultures. It's fine. But I just hate it. And we hit turbulence, and I just all butterflies inside. And yeah, it's just, yeah, it's not good.
Oof. Boy, oh boy. I was on a plane quite recently, and I'm not a terrible flyer, but like, it's the takeoff that I hate, because it never feels like the plane's actually going to get in the air.
Yeah, yeah, because you get that kind of like dipping, don't you? Like, yeah, you feel like you're going into the seat and then you're going out. You know, it's weird.
It feels
yeah.
like the pilot's fucking it up, right? Yeah. That's just what it feels like when you're climbing. But the thing that I do is to watch the air stewards, because if they're calm, then it's fine.
Yeah. Correct.
This time, I watched the air steward as she was sat down, and she was having ear trouble. So she looked like she was in massive pain, like trying to fix her ear to make it not hurt anymore. And she looked terrified. And I was like, well, I can't look at the air steward because now I'm terrified. Yeah, planes, man, it's weird. Big metal tube in the sky. I mean, come on. So, scariest situation I've ever been in. I was playing Tenchu Stealth Assassin with my friend, which dates this story. Great, great game. That franchise needs to come back. And we started to smell smoke. And then we walked out of his bedroom, and his house was absolutely filled with smoke. And we were the only ones there. And his parents had gone out somewhere. So we remembered our training from school, and we crawled on the floor and like crawled down the stairs and crawled out the front door. And it was such an absurd situation that we were like laughing as we did it. And it turned out that there was a big fire in the kitchen.
Oh, God.
Because my friend's mum had left something in the oven after they went out. So, you know, smoke inhalation's no joke, but we got on the floor and crawled out of the house. That was bonkers.
Wow.
You said about training. Was this training you got from Tenchu? Were you like ninja crawling?
Right. Okay, the ninja's about this. Should have used the grappling hook to go out the window. That's what we should have done.
Tenchu's what did she leave in the oven? Did you know?
Chicken, I think. Chicken. I know. And then when she got back, she was cross with us.
What?
Wow.
So very unlikely that my friend was listening.
The house was fine though, right? It wasn't like gone, wasn't it?
The house was fine. It was a you know, quote, minor fire, but it felt pretty serious at the time.
No shit.
Like, the house was filled with smoke. It was ridiculous.
Damn.
So yeah. But we're all still here to talk about our favorite pop culture from current times. So if we're all sitting comfortably, let's prepare to fast forward. Rich, I'm going to come to you first.
Yes.
And I'm going to ask you what you've been watching on the telly box.
Other than Succession, which I know we could talk about until the end of time, I've been watching, well, I've just now finished, as it's now come to an end, Ted Lasso, which is on Apple TV. Yeah, I'm really sad to see that show go. It's I assume it is completely fully ended. I think it has. It feels like it wrapped everything up nicely, that it's done. And I think it was a show that came around the right time, because I think the first season came out when we were kind of right in the midst of COVID. And it is such a lovely, sweet, wholesome, just positive show that kind of thing usually can put me off, because it can just be way too saccharine and just like, ugh, I don't like this. It's a bit too much to a bit too much for my taste buds, if you will. It just feels too sickly and sweet. But I think Ted Lasso is just such a lovely little time. I mean, Jason Sudeikis is always a good shout. I love that dude so much. I mean, the actual premise of the show is about football, and that's not something that should appeal to me whatsoever. But it's just a lovely cast of characters. Everyone's very sympathetic. There's no real overt, like, ill will, cynicism. It's just like a nice warm hug and a cup of cocoa of a show. And yeah, again, it came at such a perfect time because everyone was bloody miserable, depressed. Yeah, I think the last couple of seasons I've made it part of my weekly commute schedule, and that's now gone, and I'm really, really sad. And I don't know how many people here have watched it. There's only so many things I'm going to get into, but premise basically of the show is that you got one character, Rebecca. She's like owner of a football club. She's estranged from her ex-husband, basically as a form of payback on him. She brings in an American football coach to manage the team with the intentions that he's going to do such a shit job that the team's going to completely go under, and it's going to just completely destroy her husband because he holds the team very dear to his heart. And in the end, Ted just becomes this lovely unifying force. She befriends him. She owns up to what she's been up to. He's great for the team. He lifts up the community. And it's just really, really, really nice. And yeah, I'm sad to see it go. I really am. So
I this show made a splash when it first came out, and yeah, I was curious about it, but I never actually got around to watching it. I didn't realize that it was ending as well. I didn't realize it was over. But which, you know, Succession also now over, which is always really sad. But it's like, well, we've said this about Succession, Rich. It's like, it sucks that it's finished, but it will be this now forever. Perfectly formed. And yeah, they can't fuck it up now, right?
And I'd say as well, the last season was the strongest. It was, there were some incredible episodes, like really lovely. It's not perfect. There are things, even for me, I love the show, but some of the dialogue in it feels kind of weird. It feels like AI wrote a happy show. It just feels like a bit too forced with the niceness and some of the characters, because it's obviously all set over here. But some of the dialogue feels like it's a British actor speaking the dialogue penned by an American screenwriter, when it's like a British person wouldn't say that. It's kind of weird. It's almost like Uncanny Valley, but for dialogue, it's just a bit feels odd.
Yeah.
But then the next moment, they'll do something that just makes you have a big smiling face, and you go, aw. And it's just, it's nice.
Yeah, I should watch this show. It's weird. Some people say the same thing about Succession as well, because that's written by Jesse Armstrong, who's very British, and a lot of Americans are saying, like, some of the things they say in this are weird.
I've never noticed that, actually.
Well, I guess we wouldn't notice.
Oh, true, I guess,
the Americans that are like, you could tell a Brit right there. But yeah, so has anyone else watched Ted Lasso?
No, I had no idea it was based over here at all. I assumed it was a purely American thing that everyone seemed to start loving recently. Well, past few years, I should say. But again, it's not been on my radar because I'm not a sports person. So anything related to sports, I kind of inherently subconsciously check out of it, and then it just gets deleted. You know, I should check it out. Sounds good.
Yeah. Now, don't let the sports thing be a turn off. Like I said, it is very much about people and it's about a community, and it's sweet, and it's also kind of a bit surrealist sometimes. Some of the stuff in it, like, it's almost quite infantile, like scenarios, some of the dialogue, it's just a bit kind of absurd, but it rides the line quite nicely. It doesn't ever get too much. And also, if you play FIFA, I'm actually playing FIFA 23 today, and you actually can play as a team in it. They've got Richmond's AFC in there, and even Jason Sudeikis on the sideline as well. So, but all the players' likenesses are in there. It's brilliant. It's so good. Yeah, I love it. And it's probably the most I've ever enjoyed football outside of International Superstar Soccer 64. So it's just, yeah, wow. Great show. Sad to see it go. That rhymed. So
I was the same as Chris. Anything sport-related, particularly football, I just bounce off completely. But, sounds like I should put that to one side and give this a watch. Jason, have you watched this?
We got Apple TV for free, you know, one of the stupid promotion things from my phone or whatever. So we watched a few other things on Apple TV, and I kept saying to my wife, like, we should watch this Ted Lasso. It's supposed to be really good. I know it's based off football, but I think we should give it a shot. You know, we can watch one episode, see if we like it. If not, then we can move on. So she agreed. You know, she's not a sports fan. She hates football. I mean, I don't mind football. I quite enjoy watching it when I do. So we jumped into episode one and we were in straight away. And we just power watched because this was like 2 months ago that we decided to do this. And we binge watched the first two seasons quite rapidly and then caught up with season three. And we had to just stop for a little bit just so the TV drops could kind of catch up with us so we could binge watch the rest of it. But yeah, it just sucked us straight in with everything that Rich has said about the show. Like, it's just such a feel-good, wholesome TV show that you can't not help walk away from watching that show and feel good about yourself and to feel good about the human race, which is quite nice considering how shitty we can be.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, like Ted himself, he's such a strong, positive person. He's such a great role model for how we could be, even through the troubles that he goes through in this show. I mean, it's not all good. It's not all just all positive, you know, this, that, and the other. They do go into heavy subjects mm-hmm. sometimes. They can talk about politics have been brought into it. You know, love and relationships are in this. And mental health as well is brought up quite a lot. You know, Ted goes through a lot with that. I'm trying not to say too much about spoilers, but yeah. So they can go dark or into darker areas as well. But the way in which they tackle these subjects is really well done. And yeah, it's just a really positive show to watch. And because it's all based around football as well, it's kind of interesting just to see that side of it as well. It's very British, you know, obviously it's filmed over here. It's all mostly British actors. So, you know, it really feels like you're watching a BBC show mm-hmm. kind of thing as well. So that kind of aspect is quite appealing to me because I feel like I'm watching an old school kind of English telly show as well. So, it's just really cool. You know, I love how Ted always comes in every morning and like he bakes biscuits for the man for his boss,
yeah.
And like he puts him in this nice little pink box, and then he brings a little box of homemade biscuits into his boss every single morning, and that never stops for the whole three series. Yeah. He's still doing that at the end, and just little things like that. It's just really cool.
Yeah,
I'm liking how heartwarming and nice this sounds. Mm. My partner likes to watch like dramas and stuff. But after she's done with work, sometimes she's like, I can't watch anything that's got any, that's like high stakes or there's any peril.
It's the perfect show to watch.
It sounds like I need to make a point of getting this.
What's nice is it uses the football as a means. I mean, obviously there's the relationship side, but it's nice in that it uses the football to kind of give the stakes. Because obviously that's kind of the end goal, is you're seeing the success of the team, how the community perceives the team, perceives Ted. So you're watching the on-pitch stuff. And that is like, I'm on the train sometimes watching it and my like heart's in my throat because I'm like tense because it's like, you know, the team's on the defensive, they're down a few goals, you know, God, they're going to pull this together. And it's like proper pulls you in because it's a nice backdrop to the narrative. Yeah. It kind of is the culmination of everything that led to the football game. Because, you know, the team might not be getting along or they're demotivated. Something's happened that's just messed up their psyche. And it's really good stuff. So must watch it.
One of the reasons why I don't like football so much is because I always perceive it as kind of like a toxic, gross world that I don't want to be involved with.
So
I also like the sound of it, sort of taking the edge off that.
Football just, as soon as I start hearing about it on the news, it bores me. My brother was obsessed with football, still is, so I grew up in that kind of a house. I just never saw what people loved in the game. Like, the way you guys are dressing it, I assumed it was an American show. I'd seen it trending, I'd seen clips, I assumed it was an American football show. I had no idea it was in this country with English football. And
I think it might be an American show, it's filmed over here and
But you guys have kind of sold it as this nice, easygoing, touching little drama.
It's just nice.
And
so, it's an easy watch as well. I mean, it's not one of those shows where it's like 25-minute episodes. Some of them are like almost an hour. But it's just easy viewing. It pulls you in, nice plot threads. It never gets anxiety inducing to watch. It doesn't get you down, doesn't toy with you. It just, I don't know.
The characters are quite interesting as well. Sorry, just as a last minute to Ted. And Roy Kent is just a legend.
Roy Kent's the man.
Love Roy Kent.
Love Roy Kent.
I'll have to queue it up and find a source for it.
Chris, with your fast-paced culinary lifestyle, I know it's kind of tough to watch a lot of telly lately, but have you been watching anything? Is there anything you want to bring to the table?
Not recently. I have been introducing my wife to Strange New Worlds, and she loved it. And we've recently rewatched Firefly and finished with Serenity as well. So
Is Firefly canny? How does that feel to go back to? Because I haven't seen it in a long time, and I've been toying with the idea of going back to it.
It's one of my comfort shows. It again is, you know, everyone's got plot armor apart from the guest stars, and we just decided. I can't remember. It's a YouTube video celebrated it or something, and we're like, oh, we'll pop it on. So over the course of a week or two, we sort of on an episode a night and just revisited it, and it holds up well, visually and story-wise. There are a few dated things, but we revisited that recently, and obviously we don't spend much time together at the moment, so I've been slipping back into my my comfort shows and rewatching old shows. But one show that we haven't talked about on any recording, I believe we've mentioned it, is Good Omens. And to be a completely opposite, anti-establishment, anti-religion thing couldn't be far from Ted Lasso if it tried. It is not aggressively anti-establishment, but it is enjoyable, and it is very self-aware of itself, as is Neil Gaiman, the author, or co-author, I should say. And has anyone watched Good Omens at all? Because it's coming back in a few weeks.
It is.
Yeah.
I watched it at the time and I very much enjoyed it. It's a bit bonkers, but it's, Michael Sheen and David Tennant are, I mean, they're the reason you watch the show. They're extremely good.
Yeah. Neil Gaiman, David Tennant, Michael Sheen. If it wasn't for those guys, this show wouldn't exist. And I was on the fence. When I first watched it, I was a bit like, okay, we'll give it a go. I'd read a bit of the book, I think, at school or college. I couldn't keep up with it because being in your game, fantasy is not really my genre at all, especially reading. And it was a bit, okay, where's this going? And then you lose track. But when the show came out, I was a bit unsure because it seemed a bit, I don't know, not unpolished. But maybe I just wasn't in the mood, I don't know. But then I rewatched it late last year again. And then we rewatched it 3 or 4 weeks ago to prepare for season two. It landed beautifully, cynically, with current understandings and current news of the establishment thinking they're righteous and they're not. Let people live their lives free. And you've got Crowley, who is he's a demon, basically, and he wants the human race to suffer for all it's done in the world. The Neil Gaiman, who is a self-professed atheist, to write or co-write a show based around religion, but using a very vague veil of, is it religion or is it something supernatural, like alien? Yeah, and it's balanced beautifully well. And for instance, Crowley invents the M25 to make the human race suffer.
That's awesome. Okay, I like that. That's my sense of humor.
And when that joke landed, I was just like, where's the rest of this show? I need to see the rest of this show. I think that was episode 2. And it was a throwaway comment. It wasn't even made. Like, it said, then I created this thing to, put everyone into eternal, damnation and whatever. And Michael Sheen turned around and says, the M25, Crowley, that was a masterstroke. And I was just like, I'm in.
Brilliant.
That's brilliant. That is.
The book was, it's Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett, right? Yes. That wrote the book. That felt like a Pratchett one to me.
Very much so. I think Terry Pratchett's the establishment cynicism and Neil Gaiman's the supernatural fantasy element. And it just...
It is interesting that, because as an atheist, he wrote that, and it's not like insultingly
anti-religion.
It just has no reverence for religion. And it's an interesting take because he doesn't say all of that's bollocks. He says, all of that's real. You're just all completely wrong about it.
Yeah.
Like the way you've interpreted it is bullshit, and for your own designs, and it is a really it's a unique take on that whole thing.
Yeah, and I was just kind of blown away at the social themes of the whole thing, where it turns out that things that you think this person accused of a witch of being a witch has these foreshadow visions of the future that turn out to be true. The Antichrist is true. Crowley delivers the Antichrist where it's supposed to be, but accidentally ends up in the care of the wrong parents at an orphanage.
Okay, that's
so
cool.
When
that's
you cool. flash forward from then to present day, and the Antichrist is starting to manifest, they find the wrong parents. But in this scripture that was written by someone called Agnes Nutter about 400 years prior, that's a great joke. Written by a Nutter.
I didn't even. Oh, yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. It's just one of those perfect play on words. They get the wrong kid, and this kid is living a normal life, but having some weird manifestations of stuff. But the whole show in general is just about Aziraphale and Crowley. You've got the human race loving Aziraphale, who is very cynical, but he loves human. He loves human ideals and human comforts. He owns an antique bookshop with books that he's collected over the thousands of years in this bookshop. He likes tea, he likes cake, and he likes posh lunches at the Savoy and the Ritz. Whereas Crowley is your leather coat wearing, sunglasses indoors wearing anarchist type who drives a burning car. But the way that those two play off each other is fantastic. And Michael Sheen is just fantastic. I had not really seen anything with Michael Sheen in until this. Not properly. But then when you realise what actors are capable of when they're given good material, you realise, fuck, why was I not involved, interested in that before?
Mm.
Yes. But Michael Sheen was in Twilight, I'm fairly sure.
Yes.
He was indeed, yes.
I would say perhaps not fertile ground for Michael Sheen's acting prowess.
That's the thing. Like, I think I'd only seen
him. Most people have seen him in, but he's great. He's great in everything he's in.
I think I'd only seen him previously. Again, another football biopic. He played Brian Clough that I never watched.
Yeah,
but I watched. Must be very, very long ago now. He did a short film about Kenneth Williams, and he played Kenneth Williams.
Oh, really?
Yeah, if anyone's not familiar with Kenneth Williams, he was a very talented impressionist and comedian and actor from Carry On films who was unfairly maligned in his early career for his life choices. And he documented the last days of Kenneth Williams' life. And it was fantastic. I realised, wait a minute, who's this guy doing this on point Kenneth Williams? Not an impression, it was more of a... I'm playing Kenneth Williams. And then he turned up in Twilight, obviously. It's great. Everyone taints David Tennant as that Shakespearean actor, but him in Good Omens is fantastic. It's probably one of the best roles he's ever played. And I love it because he's playing such against type. But again with Good Omens, when you read into it, like you said, Steve, it's not telling you that religion's wrong. It is supporting everyone's belief, but at the same time going, what if?
Yeah.
Michael McKean turns up. Yeah.
Of it, right?
And Michael McKean turns up as like a fourth generation. Ooh. Yeah. A fourth generation demon hunter and witch hunter. And then Jack Whitehall turns up as another generational bloodline of. Yeah. Yeah. He's fine. He's a bit miscast. Yeah. He's a bit miscast. He's a bit miscast in it. It doesn't really. Yeah. Just like James Acaster is miscast in Ghostbusters, but we won't go into that, lads. And Frances McDormand is the voice of God, and God narrates the entire show. And
that's right. Yeah.
And it's the most beautifully Frances McDormand cynicism commentary on religion and everyone's understandings of it. Stephen Fry turns up. Literally every British actor you can think of turns up. John Hamm plays Gabriel.
Yeah,
nice.
it's just insane. It's one of those shows that I think I can't describe it. You just, if you guys are you know, not anti-religion, but you have your different understandings of it. You sit there and every time you rewatch it, you see and you hear more gags and commentary on the establishment. The whole show is basically an anti-establishment commentary, not just religion.
Yeah.
Which everyone seems to paint it with that. Oh, it's a show about throwing out religion. No, it's not. It is showing you the absurdities of everyday life and why we are stuck in this routine of work. You get tokens, you exchange tokens to survive. Why is that a thing? Why do we do that? And it loosely talks about government, local governments, prophecy, books, religion. It covers everything, but in a very vague way. And you can see so much in it.
So I think you touched on it slightly. It's not a perfect show. It does sort of sag under its own weight a little bit here and there. And I think I remember particularly like towards the end of the series, starts to feel like it's going to spin apart at the seams.
Mm.
You know, Series 2 is exciting. I'm probably going to have to go back and rewatch the first one because it is really good. Jason, what have you been watching?
Can I talk about what I've been playing?
You can, yeah. If you've not been watching, you can talk about what you've been playing.
Okay. Well, I've been playing Tears of the Kingdom, obviously, because that's what mostly everybody's playing that I know of anyway. But I'm going to try not to talk about the game specifically too much because I'm sure people that are listening might have heard other people talk about this game and about all the in and outs and mechanics and everything else that this game brings. But I mean, I've been a big Zelda fan for practically all my life. You know, Link to the Past was my first big Zelda game, and I instantly fell in love with the franchise, and I just carried on from there, and I've played most of them. When Breath of the Wild came out, it took my breath away, and it became my favorite game, you know, not just my favorite Zelda game, but just my favorite game in general, because of the way it just encapsulated me. You know, I got quite obsessed with it. I couldn't stop playing it, and I just wanted to explore everything about this game. And I was quite sad afterwards, after I'd finished it and stopped playing it, because of the emotions that I felt playing that game and thinking that I'd never feel that again. I'd never have that experience again because I've played the game now. You know, that's it. And when they announced Tears of the Kingdom, and we found out that it was going to share the same map as Breath of the Wild, you know, and it, you know, there was a bit of trepidation in my brain because of that, you know, like, how can they make this game different to Breath of the Wild using the same map and all this and that and the other. But I had faith in Nintendo. I had faith in the Zelda team. They managed to pull one of the best games ever created out there are, so surely they knew what they were doing and what they knew they were onto a winner by reusing the same map. So booting up Tears of the Kingdom for the first time, you know, you have a whole tutorial area of learning all the new mechanics and stuff, which was really cool. And that's all done in the sky. And then you do all that and then you land in Hyrule on the surface. But man, it just gave me all those feelings all over again and I wasn't expecting it. I literally got just so sucked into this game that life just had to revolve around it, which was troublesome in some ways.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I grabbed any second that I could to get back to the game and play it. Like, it got its hooks in me that much. And, you know, I would play it before I started work. I would play it in my lunch. I would play it longer than I should have at work. I would come home. I would play it at home. I'd stay up late and play it. I'd stay up too late to play it and feel really tired the next morning, but I didn't care. I just did the whole cycle all over again. I was so happy that it gave me those feelings that I had playing Breath of the Wild again. And I wasn't expecting that. I didn't know what to expect when I started the game. But that wasn't one of them. And I was so happy that I just was able to have these moments again and relive Breath of the Wild again in some form or another, but through this new game. I think that's one of the biggest things I've taken away from it, and why Tears of the Kingdom is probably now a special game for me for those reasons of being able to, I don't know if any other game's been able to recapture those moments in the game and done it again before. I don't think I've ever had that when I've played another game in another series of games. I don't think so. And yeah, just an incredible game.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, it's not perfect. I mean, what isn't? But it's just...
Yeah. I mean, I've been playing this as well. I'm not nearly... I mean, you finished it now, right?
I've rolled credits, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, there's still lots to do.
Yeah. It is kind of remarkable how they managed to pull it off again. And it's... Because Breath of the Wild was, you know, incredible... And there's that sort of difficult second album syndrome where it's like, well, how do we make a game that has that much impact again? And they set about doing it again by just doing it again. And like you, I was a bit worried because it was like, yeah, the same map, but there's floating islands in the sky. I don't know. That sounds not lazy necessarily, but it doesn't sound like it would be enough for me to come back. But describing it that way is really reductive because... It's the same topography, but just about every inch of Hyrule has got something in it that's changed. Mm-hmm. And to call them islands in the sky does a disservice because, as you said, the tutorial opens up on one of these islands in the sky and it's just incredibly well done. Roaming around that tutorial area as it's floating in the sky is just like, it feels like magic. It's just so good. It's so, so well done. They reuse a lot of stuff, like a lot of the music is the same and a lot of the sound effects are the same, but all of those things serve as like familiar elements. That's like welcoming you back. It's like, welcome back.
That's nice.
Home again. Some things have changed though, and we're going to slowly reveal these to you. And yeah, it's difficult to describe, but they found a really good balance of making the same game again, but with a completely different, I don't know, it feels completely different. It feels different enough. It's so good.
You hit on something there, Steve, because I think one of the other things I wasn't expecting from this game was nostalgia. And I got big doses of nostalgia by revisiting the places that I visited the first time in Breath of the Wild and going back to these places and going, oh yeah, I remember this happening in Breath of the Wild. And I go, oh yeah, I remember that happening in Breath of the Wild. And that was really cool moments for me playing the game because, and like I say, it was another unexpected emotion that I experienced playing it because that was the last thing that I thought I would ever have playing Tears of the Kingdom was nostalgia for these places and for these characters and things. And that was just another extra element on top of everything else that just made it even more special.
Yeah. I mean, Breath of the Wild came out, what, 7 years ago?
6 years ago.
6 years ago. Jeez. So it doesn't feel like it's that long, really. But yeah, you definitely get these warm, comforting feelings of like, oh, well, no, we're back. We're back here. I can do this all over again, and it's all new, but really familiar. I also feel like I really enjoy the tone of it as well, because I'm not like, I really like Zelda games, but I don't know a ton about them. But my understanding is that every Zelda game like reinvents everything. Like you have things come across, like characters can appear again, but they're different characters. They just look and sound the same. But like the world is reinvented every time, right? That's my understanding of how Zelda works as a franchise.
Yeah.
So is this the first time that we've had a Zelda game that is the same world as the previous one?
But Majora's Mask,
like
didn't it? Did Majora's Mask? Was that a follow on?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't feel like maybe. I know it uses the same engine.
Yeah, I thought it was the same.
I don't know if it's like directly story-wise.
I thought it was the same Hyrule and everything.
Yeah, I do believe it's the same because a lot of people call this. A lot of people are calling this Tears of the Kingdom the Breath of the Wild's Majora's Mask.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can see that, but it really adds something to it. Like the stable remembered that I had a horse stabled from Breath
that's
of
right,
the Wild.
Yeah.
It's like, I was finished naming my horse Gavin or whatever, and then the guy's like, oh, you've already got a horse here. Ian's still here from last time. And like the towers that you use to map the area, they've like retrofitted them with the sentinels from Breath of the Wild. So like sentinel arms come out and do stuff, but like they're friendly now. They've managed to change them to they're friendly. And yeah, and you see the eye symbol, like the Sheikah symbol all over the place. But like that's all happened now and that's done. But we've moved on from that now. But there's like traces of it still lying around. It's cool. It's really, really well done.
I think one of the biggest criticisms about Breath of the Wild was how empty it can be at places. And to me, that was an attractive thing for me because of how empty it can be. And you're just exploring this vast land. And
yeah, it's kind of bleak, Breath of the Wild. Like, it's got like a post-civilization sort of light to it. Yeah.
But yeah, I like that because, yeah, again, I read somewhere it's like, well, you know, they're in this kind of world where they're really scared of this, of the Calamity Ganon and everything that's going on. So maybe there wouldn't be a lot of people hanging around because, you know, they're all scared and they just want to hide. Whereas in Tears of the Kingdom, it's all post this and they're just everywhere. And there were times playing the game that I did feel quite overwhelmed with how much stuff that they've actually put into the game. Like there's so much to do now that it was hard to concentrate on doing one particular task. And then, you know, that's good in a way because it leads you on journeys that you wouldn't expect to happen. Like, you know, you set this yourself this task to go and do this side mission or whatever. And then before you know it, you've seen the shrine, you go and see the shrine, but then you've got to do something to get the shrine and then you go and do that. But then while you're doing that, you could see something else and go and do that. And before you know it, you've completely forgotten the original quest that you were doing because you've just sidetracked all these different ones. And it did feel quite overwhelming in places because there's that much stuff packed into this game. But in some ways that just makes the game even more because you're getting so much for your money because there is so much to do in this game. And like the Zelda always breaks my gaming rules. I mean, my gaming rules is I don't like to play games that are like longer than 20 hours. I don't necessarily go out to play RPGs and this and the other, but for Zelda, I always break these rules. But, you know, 130 hours in, you know, it's
not been out that long, Jason.
Seriously.
And I'm still going. Like
2 weeks and it's been out. What?
Wow.
Yeah.
Three weeks.
Someone do the maths on that and get hours per day.
Yeah. So just I could go into everything else that the game has done, but I won't because I'll be here for another hour at least, just rabbiting on. Yeah, it's been an experience, it's been an obsession, it's been something I won't forget. And just thank you, Nintendo, for making the game. It's just been, and thank you to my wife for her patience of me just like powering through the game when we're watching TV. And like I say, at any other point that I could get just to play it, I did get quite worried for myself at some point. That's why I was pretty quiet over those 3 weeks on the internet and in the group and on Discord and such because I was just too busy. Just too busy playing the game. That Indiana Jones podcast that we recorded like 3 weeks ago, I've only just got around to doing it because I was too busy playing Zelda.
Unbelievable. That's unbelievable.
No one can hold that against you.
Coming from someone who's not a hardcore gamer and never has been and hasn't played a Zelda game in a very long time, would you consider the new one a decent jumping on point to see what the whole thing's about?
Yes.
I'm looking for something different. Something to...
I guess the beauty of these new Zeldas is that you can do as much or as little as you want.
Yeah.
You could just literally just do the storyline and then move on with your life. You could, you know, or, you know, so you could try and do the whole thing. It's completely up to you. There's a whole new layer in the game with the depths, and the depths cover the entire area of the map.
Yeah.
But underground.
When I first went down into the depths, I was just like, man, fuck you, Zelda. There's a whole other game here underground. What are you doing to me?
Because I remember being blown away when they launch the Switch with Zelda.
They did, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And when I was watching people doing playthroughs and stuff, and for the first time for a long while, I considered Maybe I should get into Zelda games, because this whole sandbox open world looks fucking phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then I let it brush by. I didn't buy a Switch, and then I got a Switch, and then the new Zelda game's out, and it's been 7 years, and that's crazy.
Yeah.
But I might give it a go, see what's going on.
I mean, I think Tears of the Kingdom's controls are probably a bit more sophisticated than Breath of the Wild, because it's got a lot more mechanics going on in the game. I mean, every single button is utilized on the control pad, and sometimes more than one button needs to be used to do certain things. So it can take a while to get used to that control scheme, whereas Breath of the Wild is a lot simpler. There's not as much going on that side. So maybe you may want to jump on Breath of the Wild first and just see how you go with that one before you jump into Tears.
That's what I thought I'd ask, because if the games are all identical but also not identical at the same time, I just thought I'd ask, would it make more sense for me to buy the recent one?
If you're not fussed about not playing the latest hotness, Breath of the Wild, you should.
Just as a slice of gaming history, that I still remember now, like when you step out onto the plateau the first time, I was like, "Fuck, this game's gonna rule!" Like, and I was never massively into big open worlds of RPG style games, and I got this for that first Christmas. I had the Switch, and it just dug its claws into me. I was just like, I was on the ride. I loved it. It's magical, and I would get Breath of the Wild. It's probably still £50 now, Nintendo, but that's all right.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. That's what puts me off when I look at stuff and I'm like, what the fuck, eShop? Are you kidding? Like,
I think someone just pointed out as well, like, one of the other things playing the game that I marveled in was the fact that this game doesn't have an XP system. You know, it's not a Sony game. It's not an Xbox game. You don't have any of this stuff. You can upgrade your armor if you want to, but I mean, I think I did it twice throughout the whole playtime that I've done so far, and I did fine. I completed the game. There's nothing that you wouldn't expect to find in a big Sony game, and I found that really refreshing as well, not to have all that kind of stuff in the game. And the fact that this game comes in at about 16, 17 gigs, something like that in total.
How do they do it? Seriously.
That is honestly insane.
As well, when you see what this game looks like and how it runs, it's fucking incredible that that's on a Switch. It is unbelievable how good it looks and how well it runs on a Switch.
Half a cartridge. Half a cartridge. That's the maximum capacity. What the hell? I don't know how Nintendo optimized their games. It's ridiculous.
It's nuts. It's nuts. There's so much heart and soul poured into this thing. It's ridiculous.
I remember watching when the Switch was out for a couple of years. Some guys in Los Angeles went to the top of what's that fucking mountain up there? They went up to the top of the mountain on bikes and set all their switches up and networked and played a game on the Switch, and they were like, this is so powerful for such a small system. You could network on the top of a mountain essentially and play a multiplayer game with no lag between the console. It's just insane that little thing is capable of so much. And then when you put it onto your TV as well, you're like, fuck, Jesus Christ. I don't know. It's witchcraft.
When you consider it's running on a mobile phone, CPU,
it's a 10-year-old tablet. Yeah. It's like a 10-year-old tablet, that thing. Yeah. Like, the guts of that thing are ancient.
I mean, the processor was 2 years, out of date when the Switch launched. It's witchcraft.
Nintendo just really know how to squeeze everything out of it. It's crazy. Yeah, I really like that point that you make, Jason, where every element of the game is just direct input from you as a player. You're not making numbers go up or grinding to make a percentage higher or whatever. It's all just like fighting monsters in that game is inherently like all you do when you fight is you lose resources. Like, there's no benefit. Do it anyway, because it feels good and it's fun, and that's why you should play games. You don't need these layers of metagame on top with stats and graphs and shit. It is a very pure feeling experience.
As I've gotten older, I can't stand that in games now. That's probably what puts me off most games, is like, oh great, so I've got to build up XP and certain amounts of equipment to do this. It's like, fuck you, game, just throw me into it, let me work my way through the campaign and do all the little side quests. That's all I want to do.
That's why I like my nice, 7-hour long, just narrative games.
Yeah.
It's just, you just jump in, it takes you on the journey, spits you back out, next one. I still don't mind the odd big open world like AAA game. I play the Yakuza games, for fuck's sake. Yeah, I know about putting a shift in to roll credits on a game, but more and more, I think my experiences, I want them to be smaller. But I'd probably still make an exception for Tears of the Kingdom, because case in point being Breath of the Wild, where that totally won me over when I wasn't massively into that kind of game.
There are like some 100% moments in this game that just, well, they left me jaw dropped. I just couldn't believe that Nintendo were doing this. I couldn't believe where the story was going. I couldn't believe some of the areas that I played through and experienced and the bosses. It was just, yeah, it has to be my favorite game again from now. It has to be. It just, everything about it just,
I mean, we won't go into it, but the main new mechanic in this game is like a building. It's a building mechanic where you can just build stuff.
Banjo-Kazooie nuts and bolts.
You can put wheels on shit and put an engine on it and a joystick. Like, you could just make a car out of wood and stuff.
That's nuts.
It's nuts.
Fucking hell, man.
Bonkers. And like the physics, it's the best physics engine I've ever seen in a game. Like, the physics work perfectly.
Wow.
Nothing behaves weird. There's no wonky physics in this game. They've dialed it in perfectly, and everything behaves exactly like you would expect it to. It's crazy.
You're selling it to me even more.
Yeah.
Like,
that's so good.
Definitely go play this game.
Just check out some videos on Twitter of some of the creations that people have come up with, and like the mech robot thing just blew me away.
Yeah.
Like, they built this complete robot, put cannons on it. You can get like a control stick that you can put on the things as well, and you can get like a, I think they call them a beam emitter in the game, but it's pretty much just like a laser gun. And like, he's literally just stomping around Hyrule, blasting the crap out of anything that he can see on this like transformer robot style thing. And like, it's just so bizarre to see something, well, it's bizarre but also very awesome to see something like this in a Zelda game.
Right, Rich, I'm going to ask you what game you've been playing.
I've been playing Ocho. It took me too long to realise how it actually was pronounced, and it is Ocho, O-T-X-O, for those that are interested. Basically, it follows the same beat as like your Hotline Miami kind of roguelike top-down shooter, incredibly violent, nice dark synthwave music, you know, really like you're in a John Wick film, basically. And it's the visuals in this, where it's different. I wouldn't say the visual style was like massively inspired, but it looks nice. It's monochrome, which is always good. Blood's red, obviously. Fantastic. And I really, really, really enjoy it. It's the same kind of gameplay loop as the other games. You enter a room, you clear said room or all rooms across one floor, just shooting everyone on sight. You go for the exit. Next. What I like about this a little bit more than Hotline Miami is that this is still hard as balls, but what I found with this is that you can take like 20 shots. You actually have like a health meter instead of it being like a one-shot kill with a Hotline Miami. But the enemies will go down pretty much with one bullet. Or in the case of this, it's a kick, not a punch. You actually kick doors open and you kick enemies to death. And yeah, so it's, yeah, one hit for the enemies. You can take a few bullets. You drink liquors as well. You go to a bar, you order drinks. And it gives you different abilities and buffers and stuff like that. So it does things differently. You could say it's more forgiving because of the health bar system. What I like about it is that because it's not like a one shot and you're dead kind of mechanic, you don't have to stealth around and do the old turtling that you do in Hotline Miami, where you're being super cautious. You can go in like really aggressive, guns blazing, feet kicking, just killing everyone on the sight. Yeah, it's really addictive. It's a nice, simple gameplay loop. It's unforgiving at times. It will kick you back to the start if you get killed. I haven't sworn too much playing it. I find it dulls it in enough that you're not like pissed off it sent you back like so far. It's pretty much the beginning of the first room you went to. Try again, try again, try again. Yeah, soundtrack absolutely slaps. It's fucking brilliant. I think one guy made this game and did the music as well. So It's really, really, really good. I've not delved too much into this kind of genre. I mean, I've done this. I've played a bit of Hong Kong Massacre and obviously the aforementioned Hotline Miami. And it's probably the most I've enjoyed it across the lot because it's a bit more forgiving while still being unforgiving. I don't know how they've quite pulled that off, but they have. It's awesome. Definitely give it a go. Wow. And obviously, if you've watched the latest John Wick, now's a good time to play this because there's a scene in that film that it mirrors these games and it's such a blast. You feel unstoppable. You feel like a badass. And yeah, you should play it.
Well, I just watched a bit of YouTube of it. There's like bullet timey stuff going on.
Oh yeah, that's the point. Yeah, there's a slowdown mechanic as well, which in a way I guess makes it feel a bit cheap and that it makes the things feel a little bit easier, but I love bullet time. It's great. Could have bullet time.
I mean, what's not to love? I absolutely loved Hotline Miami and Hotline Miami 2. So I'm way into playing this game.
Mm.
And as much as I love those games, that whole thing was that it was brutal and unforgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be doing incredibly well and then you put a foot wrong and a second later you're back at the beginning again. Lost your progress. So I'm up for something that's Hotline Miami-ish, but not quite as bit in your face, fuck you hard as those games are.
Yeah, I'd definitely say it gets it about right. It still feels hard as nails, but I wasn't aggravated, so which is perfect, really. I mean, there's games like that. I can easily lose my rag, but games like this, games like Celeste, they challenge you, but they're not taking the piss. It's appreciated because I don't have enough time to be like not enjoying a game. So it's class. Yeah, recommended.
It sounds like a nice gratuitous power fantasy. I'm into that.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to the soundtrack on Spotify after it. Said at some point how the soundtrack bangs, and it really, really does. It's actually a really cool soundtrack to listen to just on its own, even if you've not played the game. It's like real proper dancey, banging soundtrack. It's really cool. I must say thank you to Superware Originals for supplying us with a Steam code for that game. And if you are listening, Ryan, then sorry for the late delay in the coverage, but we got there eventually.
And also sold a copy because I bought it.
Yes.
There you go.
There you go. Jason, you've been watching Yellow Jackets, so I hear.
I have, yes.
How's that?
Really good, actually. We got Paramount Plus for like £3 a month for the next 3 months. So with Strange New World Series 2 coming up, I thought, fuck it, why not? Mm-hmm. At least I'd be guaranteed to be able to watch that. So we were browsing the catalogue and we found this program called Yellow Jackets. I didn't really know much about it, but it looked intriguing. So we thought we'd give it a go. And we've just watched the first series. We finished that this morning. I'm having a really good time with it. It's not what I expected in some ways, but the basic premise of the show is that there's an all-girl soccer team for a high school and they get through to the nationals. So I can't remember where these nationals were being held, but they needed to go on an airplane ride to get there. But unfortunately, halfway there, which kind of funnily rolls into our opening conversation. The plane gets into trouble and crashes.
Fucking it. Just need a spider for the Holy Trinity of fear and then we're done.
Yeah, unfortunately, the plane crashes in the Ontario Mountains, I think. And then it's just about how these guys survive the isolation of being on their own in the wilderness. But the program also flicks between this time, which is based in the 90s, which is pretty rad because the soundtrack to the TV show is phenomenal. They're like one 90s hit after another is coming at you and it's brilliant. But then it flickers to the present day and follows some of the girls in their adulthood. So straight away, you know that some of them survived and was rescued, which is quite a brave decision, I thought, from the producers. But it works because batshit crazy stuff happens to the adult versions of these people as well. And, you know, from the emotional scars that they carry from going through what they went through back when they were teenagers and what kind of scars that have been left on them. So they kind of explore that side as well as some other bits. So it's quite interesting to flick between these two time periods and what's going on between them. But it's really gory. It's very violent. you know, it's plane crashes, you know, it cuts to like some person that some poles going straight through their chest, through the back of the chair. You know, you have to, someone has to chop someone's leg off after the crash because, you know, it got crushed, and you see everything in its full glory, and it's quite epic, you know. And yeah, it hints at the beginning, and it has this kind of like horror kind of vibe that starts to progress through the show, and that starts from the beginning of the first episode. Like, you get this scene that they turn into some kind of clan, some kind of tribe, and they become cannibals. And that's hinted in pretty much the first scene of the first episode. And that was really good, I thought, because it really kind of like hooked you in straight away, because it's like, well, how the hell did they get from being this normal bunch of teenage girls to there? And that kind of intrigueness just holds over you through wanting to see the next episode, as well as everything that just happens in the shows and such, you know. And by the end of the first series, I say we got to today, you can really see where it's starting to go, and it's just really good. I just didn't expect it to be so cool, and it being set in the 90s, like I say, was just an added bonus.
I watched the first couple of episodes of this, and I don't remember why, but we fell off it for some reason. But yeah, I was extremely intrigued, because like you said, straight away, you don't know who it is, but you get a flash of somebody wearing like a tribal headdress thing, and you can see teeth going into presumably human flesh, but it doesn't tell you what's actually happened there. And then it just rolls back to like, well, by the way, kids on a plane.
Yeah.
That's fucked up. What's going to happen here?
I like, it's got a great cast, and kind of what Jason set up, I like the fact that it takes you into their adult lives. You know that, like, never mind the fact you get the scene at the start, but the dialogue, you know that like shit went down, and they're kind of living with a secret. They're living with this kind of disgrace. They've got this kind of shit to their name that they don't want to let out to the, you know, the wider public. And I like that it lets you sit with that to the point that you're kind of like, what did happen? What did happen? And it gives you just enough little nuggets. And like the last episode of the first season is like really, really powerful as well. Like, it kind of messed me up a little bit. So yeah, I need to watch the second season, because I do want to see where this goes. Because even by the end of the first season, it doesn't actually fully realize what you get teased at the start. It still kind of leaves it like it's messed up, but it doesn't connect those dots. You still have yet to see how far south it goes. So obviously, I imagine that's where the second season is going to really, really pick up.
Well, apparently, it's going to be a 5-series run.
Wow,
so there's going to be 5 series of this.
Wow,
but I think the third one has been interrupted, like a lot of things right now with the writer's strike, unfortunately. But it'll be worth the wait.
We stand strong with you, Writers Guild of America.
Absolutely. Yeah, we can wait a bit longer for Yellow Jackets. Yeah,
but I'd say one more thing about it is is Christina Ricci, and this is just phenomenal as Missy.
Yeah,
she's fantastic.
I love her. Like, and just the way that she props her glasses up, you know, like a lot of us, we do it from the middle and we push it up. You know, she's got this thing where she pushes up from the side of the glass with like 3 fingers, and she never misses that. I've noticed that throughout this whole series. Like, she never misses that. She's so spookingly,
she's fucked.
Like,
she's fucked, basically. That's the best way to put it.
Fucked, yeah.
She's fucked mentally. In her head. like the stuff she does, and like, she, people in her care, is like, what's she stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, without going,
I don't know, right? Yeah. No. Won't go into it, but yeah. She does love a bit of poison, though. So
it strikes me that they've been inspired by that real story of the rugby team who crashed in the Andes.
Yeah, it's kind of like Bring It On meets Alive. That's what it feels like.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a fascinating story. That's a whole different podcast altogether, is the rugby team in the Andes who ate each other. But
the film's so good.
But if you're in that situation, and the survivors of the Andes crash even said, if you're in that situation, you have to resort to that to survive. It's human nature to survive. Would you rather die or eat one of your best mates who has said, if I die, please eat me to survive? You would have to do it because it's survival.
It's messed up.
I couldn't imagine being in that situation. However, many people have been in that situation when they've crashed in various places.
We'll eat you last, Chris, because you're the chef. So, you know, just make it nice. Make it nice for enough. Us, and then we'll smack
so is Jason.
True. All right, you both get spared until the end. until it gets desperate.
More meat on me.
It just sounds really fascinating to watch Yellow Jackets. And I had no idea Christina Ricci was part of it either. So that's
Juliette Lewis.
Juliette Lewis is in there.
Yeah.
I also always really appreciate a show or a film that tells you up front this character is going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously you see the adult versions of the children really early, and it doesn't, you don't know the fate of all of them, but you know the fate of the main ones. It takes a lot of confidence to do that, because the show's telling you there's way more interesting shit that's going to happen than who's going to die and who's not.
Yeah.
That's when you know you're in for a ride, when a show does that up front.
Yeah, do it. Go and watch Yellow Jackets. It's a fun ride.
Oh, look into that. Right. Still need to get Paramount Plus. Still keep thinking about it and then not do it.
I resent having to pay for Paramount
Plus. That's exactly why I haven't done it.
Amazon Prime feels more and more like a fucking scam every day.
Oh, mate, it is, because they sub-license all of their stuff. So you go on there and say, oh, watch that. $5 or $7.99 rental fees. Like, are you fucking kidding me? For a 40-year-old movie, you want to pay $7.99 to watch it at once? I want to.
We touched on the writer's strike earlier, but the state of streaming at the moment is an absolute mess.
Yeah.
It's a real dog's dinner.
And they're deleting stuff as well, which is another reason why the writers are striking. Because
I think Disney's deleting shit.
Yeah, if stuff isn't good enough and it tarnishes their reputation, they're deleting it out of existence.
It's a tax write-off as well. It's a tax write-off. Like Willow.
Like Batgirl. Like
People either liked Willow or they didn't. I don't know. I didn't watch it. But like, it's not going to see a physical release, right? So Disney have just fucking deleted Willow from history. It's gone forever, and that's really not okay.
It's criminal, because a lot of these things that the people delete, people have worked for, in the case of Willow and various other shows, it's been a big part of their lives for about 5 years before cameras even rolled. In pre-production, contracts, scripts, sets, props, everything. And then they just come along and buy, and HBO Max is doing the same.
And this is why, you know, I'm not being cute when I say it, but this is why there's piracy. Like, you know, that's why it's appealing.
People did a lot of pirating, and then Netflix happened, and a few other streaming services happened, and they competed with pirating directly. They were like, okay, this is more convenient, it's a really good selection, and it's relatively cheap. And pirating went way down because these companies knew that they had to compete with pirating. But they've completely forgotten that at this point, and now pirating is going to come back.
Yep.
And preservation. Companies are going to be lamenting the amount of piracy that goes on, and it's fucking their own fault because they're forgetting why TV and film gets made. It gets made because it's art and it's culture, and people want to see art and culture. It's not fucking content. Be farmed out for the extraction of money. It's gross.
But that's why there are certain shows on Netflix that we've still got a Netflix account, but once they leave, I'll be going to Paramount Plus, and that's obvious what show I'm talking about. However, they're still on Netflix. We have a Netflix account. There's no reason for me to go to Paramount. There is nothing drawing me to Paramount at the moment.
Yellow Jackets is now.
And Yellow Jackets obviously now, yeah.
I do know people that maintain one streaming service and they cancel it and re-up it depending on what shows are on and what shows aren't. But I just don't have that kind of mental capacity to stay on top of that stuff. And so Netflix and, you know, Netflix et al. Are relying on people like me, who are the vast majority, where you just click subscribe and then forget forever.
But that's how I got my deal with Paramount, because I took up their 7-day trial. I cancelled that when I took it up. So then I had the 7 days, didn't have to worry about it. And then they emailed me, like they kept emailing me, oh, would you like to come back? Would you like to resub? And then they just come back and said, you can resub for like £3 a month for 3 months if you want. I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then I'll cancel it again.
Yeah. Well, make sure you do, because otherwise they'll get you. That's how they get you, is when you forget.
I mean, I still have Disney Plus. That's the only one I really have. I don't even really watch that. But it's just nice because it's got The Simpsons on it. And Simpsons is a pain in the ass to pirate. I'm going to say that. It's just a bit.
Yeah, it is. But don't.
Sorry, I shouldn't talk about piracy. Fuck it.
No, you've read that, right? You haven't tried. You've heard it's really hard to pirate.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
But Disney Plus, what the fuck? They're promoting Indiana Jones like like it's their lifeblood at the moment, and the film's not doing well critically and test screening wise. And they only seem to be interested in people in the United States and Canada. Mm-hmm. Where's our young Indiana Jones, guys? Come on. I want to revisit that show for the first time in 30 years.
I forgot there was a new Indiana Jones.
Most people have already, and it's a bit disheartening because you're like, oh, well, never mind.
So sad. Like...
Again, they should have just left it at three. The series happened, fair enough, and then leave it at that.
This is why I'm glad they haven't, and I hope to God they don't touch Back to the Future.
They won't. As long as Robert Zemeckis and Spielberg are alive, they won't touch it. But as soon as either one of them die, they're remaking it.
It's going to happen.
However, the Dial of Destiny, man, just... oh.
Well, here's hoping in 2 hours' time from as we are recording, they might reveal some stuff from the new Indiana Jones game for the Xbox. So,
Ooh. Yeah, hopefully that crossed. Might make me buy an Xbox.
Well, but yeah, it'll be on Game Pass. Boom, day one.
Yay.
They just need to reveal it.
Yep.
Also Chris gameplay. Chris is going to own a Switch and an Xbox more than days out.
Yeah.
We at an endpoint?
I think so.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Cool. All right. Well, thank you, as always, to everyone for joining us. If you've enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to support us, then we have a Ko-fi page, where you can donate to the show starting from as little as a quid. A massive thank you to everyone who's done so far. You're all amazing. If that's not right for you right now, you can also support us by giving us a review or a rating on Apple or Spotify. And you can find those links on our website. The website you can find at thewolfiepod.com. It's a home to all of our links, back catalogues of episodes. There are some articles on there, pictures of our faces. Go and have a look at those. Everyone's really handsome. Guys, it's time to say goodbye. I'm Steve.
I'm Rich.
I'm Chris.
And I've been Jason.
Thanks very much for joining us in the present day. We'll be back in the past next time, and we hope to see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.